Welcome to Explorations in Music, a production of KALW in cooperation with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This season, a triangle for the ages. Today, a young Johannes Brahms is cursed with a compliment.
Often, I have thought that someone must and would suddenly appear. Who would bring us his mastership, springing forth like Minerva, fully armed from the head of Jove? And he has come, a young blood by whose cradle graces and heroes kept watch. He is called Johannes Brahms.
Dr. Robert Greenberg holds a Ph.D. in music composition from the University of California at Berkeley, and since 1989 has been San Francisco Performance's music historian in residence. He has performed, taught, and lectured extensively in North America and Europe. The Alexander String Quartet is among the world's premier ensembles, maintaining a busy international touring and teaching schedule and recording for their own label, Foghorn Classics. After witnessing Brahms' immense talent, Robert Schumann wrote a now infamous article that was supposed to praise Brahms. But young Johannes was not yet ready for the sudden fame. Here's Dr. Robert Greenberg.
Over lunch, on October 2nd of 1853, Robert and Clara insisted that Brahms stay with them for at least a month. Brahms wisely accepted that offer, and what ensued was, according to Brahms, the best time of his life. Hours of music, conversation, and walks in the countryside alternated with chess games, quiet moments of reading, and composing. Robert Schumann's mental illness disappeared during these weeks. Brahms's presence apparently brought him an energy and a clarity that elevated Clara's mood to the point of ecstasy, she wrote in her diary. Robert says there is nothing in the world to wish for except that heaven may preserve Brahms's health. Schumann decided to do more than just talk the talk. He contacted his publisher, the house of Breitkopf and Hartl in Leipzig, and arranged for them to publish a number of works by Brahms, Brahms's first publications. Brahms's Piano Sonata, which we sampled very briefly in C major, was published as Opus 1. The Piano Sonata in F sharp minor as Opus 2, Six Songs, Opus 3, and the E flat minor Scherzo, Opus 4. So much of the music Brahms played in that impromptu concert for the Schumanns was published the month afterwards. And Schumann didn't stop there. Oh, no. As a music critic of great renown, he came out of his self-imposed retirement as a critic to write the article, his Rhapsody on Johannes Brahms. It appeared on October 28th. Of 1853 in the Neue Zeitschrift für Musik, the new newspaper for music, a journal Schumann himself had founded back in 1834. It is a long piece. I quote it in brief part. Years have passed since I last appeared in this journal. Often I have thought that someone must and would suddenly appear, destined to give ideal presentation to the highest expression of our time. Who would bring us his mastership, springing forth like Minerva, fully armed from the head of Jove? And he has come, a young blood by whose cradle graces and heroes kept watch. He is called Johannes Brahms. His companions greet him on his first course through the world, where perhaps wounds may await him, but laurels and palms as well, unquote. 20 years old and a virtual nobody, Johannes Brahms was declared by Robert Schumann to be the new messiah of German music. Astonishing. Brahms must have swallowed really hard when he read that article. No one had to tell him that the Messiah did indeed receive laurels and palms, and then he was crucified. Carl Geringer writes, quote, "Instantly, the name of Brahms became known far beyond the limits of musical circles, and the publication of his works was eagerly awaited. One thing was already clear. It was not going to be plain sailing for this young composer. The public and the critics expected the very best after Schumann's sensational introduction," unquote. So, did Schumann do Brahms a favor by writing and publishing such an article? The pianist and conductor, Hans von Bülow, hissed in a letter to Franz Liszt, quote, "Schumann's prediction doesn't trouble my sleep in the least. 15 years ago, he said exactly the same thing about the genius of William Sterndale Bennett," unquote. And if you're thinking, who? Yes, exactly. Richard Wagner and his cronies immediately began referring to the 20-year-old Brahms as Saint Johannes. And the musical establishment in Leipzig, which considered Felix Mendelssohn to be the new Messiah, never forgave either Schumann or Brahms for the slight to their favorite son. So did Schumann do Brahms a favor by writing and publishing such an article? Ha ha, some favor. From that day on, Brahms had to work twice as hard as he might otherwise have had to do in order to prove himself, in order to justify, I think, Schumann's thoughtless, even reckless extravagance. A favor? As it turned out, the article was instead the curse. Yes, the curse. Not long after the article appeared, Brahms met and played for Hector Berlioz in Leipzig. Berlioz, the revolutionary composer of the Symphonie Fantastique and a noted conductor and a well-known music critic, was deeply impressed. He wrote to his friend, Joseph Joachim, is there anyone Joachim didn't know, about his meeting with Brahms. "Brahms has made a very deep impression upon me with his scherzo and his adagio from the F-sharp minor sonata. I am grateful for having made the acquaintance of this diffident, audacious young man who has taken it into his head to make a new music. He will suffer greatly," unquote. Yes, Berlioz was correct. Brahms would indeed suffer greatly, though Berlioz had not an inkling of just how much Brahms was going to suffer because of Schumann's article slash curse. It took very little time for the ramifications of Schumann's article to become apparent. Way too much was expected from the young Brahms way too soon. Among various other disasters, Brahms and his first piano concerto were virtually booed off the stage in Leipzig. Brahms tried to make light of these disasters, but in fact, he was cut to his soul. An upshot was that he decided not to compose, or at least not to release to the public, any music that would bring him into direct comparison with Beethoven, meaning specifically symphonies and string quartets. Well into the 1870s, 15 years after having completed his first piano concerto, and over 20 years after the appearance of the article, Brahms was still telling anyone who'd listen that, quote, "I'll never write a symphony. You have no idea how the likes of us feel when we're always hearing a giant like Beethoven behind us," unquote. At other times, Brahms also said, "I'll never write a string quartet," for all the same reasons. Okay, Brahms was not being honest. In 1873, 20 years after the publication of The Curse, at the age of 40, he finally girded his loins, fortified his cockles, and turned around to face those footsteps behind him by going public with two string quartets, which were published together in 1873 as Opus 51. It was for Brahms a huge emotional and artistic leap. He knew darn well there weren't a whole lot of composers writing string quartets in 1873, and that his quartets would inevitably be compared to those of Beethoven, and not just Beethoven's quartets in general, but Beethoven's late quartets in particular. Be that as it may, in 1873, at the age of 40, Brahms was ready. 20 years after the publication of The Curse, he was finally fully prepared to deal with its ramifications. String Quartet in C Minor, Opus 51, number 1. Like virtually every mature work by Brahms, his string quartets exhibit a really marvelous duality, combining the clarity, compositional discipline, and musical forms of the classical era, the long bygone classical era, with the expressive breadth and all the extended melodic and harmonic resources of 19th century Romanticism. Our examination of the C minor quartet will be aimed at illustrating just this classical romantic duality. Movement 1, no surprise, sonata form. Let's hear Brahms's dark and edgy theme 1. Its expressive angst is created largely by these anxiously arising melodic gestures that never quite seem to get where they're trying to go. To an absolutely stunning degree, the entire first movement grows out of the dramatic, rising melodic idea, or what's called a motive, that begins the movement. Let's just hear that motive as played by Zach. This simple rising idea is fragmented, extended, recombined, bent, spindled, and mutilated and metamorphosed over a constantly churning harmonic accompaniment to a degree that entire doctoral theses have been written about this string quartet. Having said that, this first movement is structured along the lines of a classical era sonata form, with a first and second theme, a development of those themes, and a return or recapitulation of those themes. The first movement is a perfect example of Brahms's belief that, quote, "A piece of music organized around the traditional sonata form should be nothing less than the unfolding of a single musical idea," unquote. Movement 2. Brahms calls his second movement adagio, a romanza. It's an Italian term for a romantic song. The movement begins this way. It occurs to me that I should mention to you that even though this is Brahms's first published string quartet, it is not his first string quartet. Talk about someone, and again, this has to do with The Curse and his becoming so conscious of what he wrote, really, really overconscious, that his sense of discipline, of self-discipline, went crazy. Brahms reportedly, and we have this from many sources, burned over 20 complete string quartets before he allowed this one to see the light of day. His furnace was his favorite compositional tool. Some of us say our eraser. No, Brahms's stove, his wood stove, saw the death of more music than probably any other particular machine in the history of the world. It was his shredder, and he destroyed 20 plus string quartets before he allowed this one out. The guy really did go a little crazy because he was so concerned that if nothing but the best came out, he had to make sure that what he considered the worst did not. Crazy. All right. Gorgeous second movement. And integrally connected to the first movement. Now remember, please, that the first movement grows entirely out of bits and pieces drawn from the rising motive that begins the first movement. Well, this second movement grows out of one of those very same fragments. A rising idea, repeated notes, just slowed down. Movement three. Brahms labels this third movement Allegretto, molto moderato e commodo, which means literally sort of fast, very moderate, and leisurely. It's just the sort of Brahmsian tempo designation that prompted the 20th century American composer Carl Ruggles to ask, "What the hell is that supposed to mean?" Whatever. Structurally, this third movement is a scherzo, again, a construct based on the old minuet and trio form, a relatively up-tempo middle movement structured in three parts, A, B, A. Let's hear the opening of that initial A section. Like just about everything else in this quartet, the thematic material that powers this music is a further manifestation of the motivic material that began the first movement. Another most informative back-to-back comparison. Again, the opening of the first movement. Which was used to create the opening of the second movement. Which is now extended and inverted, flipped upside down, to create the opening of the third movement. Instead of climbing up, it's going down. Now, I've said this before, and I'm saying it again, for which I'll be forgiven. For those of you who are thinking, because it's inevitable that non-composers are going to think this, yeah, but did Brahms do that on purpose, invert an idea? Would it make you feel better if you thought that he'd done it by mistake? Composition 101, okay? First year someone studies composition, you learn to write small musical ideas. And one of the things you do is if the idea works in one direction, you flip it upside down and see if it works well in the other direction. Because if it does work in inversion, now you've doubled the amount of thematic material you've got and never had to write something new. And by creating this sort of unified variety, by creating something that sounds different and yet is the same, you create a sense of consistency that the ear identifies unconsciously when listening to such music. I know such a phrase as unified variety or various unity sounds oxymoronic, but when it comes to a composer like Brahms, that's what he's doing. He's creating what sound to be contrasting ideas out of material you've already heard. And so he gets both contrast and unity at the same time. And that's what great composers do. So no, he didn't do this by mistake. It's the first thing any of us do. If we have a thematic idea that's cool, we see what else we can do with it. We flip it upside down, or we play it backwards in what's called retrograde. We see how much mileage we can get out of simple ideas, because those simple ideas now become a unified whole over time. So please, none of this is done by error. This is just the craft of good composition. Movement 4. The finale is as expressively turgid as the first movement. It begins with what by now should be a rather familiar musical idea. Fourth movement opening. We've heard that before, haven't we? Yes, at the very beginning of the quartet. By the way, just a gentle reminder, here's how the first movement began. Excuse me, he's nothing if not consistent. Like the first movement, this fourth movement is so harmonically complex that at the time it appeared, in 1873, it was compared to Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. Tristan of 1865 was considered at the time to be the ultimate in harmonic audacity. Like the first movement of this quartet, the motivic development, the metamorphosis in this fourth movement is so advanced that it has been compared to the total thematic organization of Arnold Schoenberg's music still 40 years in the future. But also, like the first movement, this fourth movement is structured in traditional sonata form. Something old, something new. The discipline of the classical era and the expressive, melodic, and harmonic substance of the Romantic era. This is the mature Brahms in action. Let's hear the opening minute and a half of this remarkable fourth movement, just to get it in our ears. Intense, and most definitely not easy listening. You know, Brahms' C minor string quartet has never been particularly popular. It is too austere, it's too craggy, it's too intense, it's too lacking in pleasurable musical niceties. But nowhere will we find a better example of Brahms as objectivist than in this string quartet. The purity of its developmental writing, the utter lack of affect, just for its own sake, the degree to which a few essential thematic ideas generate almost all of the music of the quartet, the degree to which the complex harmonic underpinning is a manifestation of the themes themselves, all of this, my friends, all of this takes us to the very edge of the 20th century. Schumann might have been reckless in his praise of the young Brahms, but you know what? He was absolutely correct. The Alexander String Quartet performs Johannes Brahms' String Quartet No. 1 in C minor of 1873. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Listening to Explorations in Music on KALW. Today's program featured Johannes Brahms' Quartet No. 1 in C minor, Opus 51. Tune in next time when we hear Clara Schumann's Piano Trio in G minor. Explorations in Music is produced for KALW by Eric Wayne in association with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. For more information about San Francisco Performances and their upcoming events, visit them on the web at sfperformances.org. The Alexander String Quartet are violinists Zacharias Grafilo and Frederick Lifsitz, violist Paul Yarbrough, and cellist Sandy Wilson. You can find out more and purchase recordings of the ASQ on their website, asq4.com. The lecturer was Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence at San Francisco Performances. The concerts were recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. You can join us on Facebook by searching for Explorations in Music. Our email address is explorations@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe.